It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Friday is the first official day of autumn. We'll talk to an expert about fall camping and ask you to share your favorite fall camping spots.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Senate Republicans are renewing the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and they're trying to vote on it as early as next week. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham, who's co-sponsoring the bill.
Every Republican out there believes that this is a fundamental reason we're in charge. That Democrats have lost a lot of seats backing a bad idea, and we've been the biggest political beneficiary of Obamacare, and we want to try to make patients the beneficiary of our idea. So at the end of the day, will we try again? I would argue that yes, we should.
Also back in the news, Hillary Clinton's loss in the 2016 election. Clinton released a new memoir that dissects what happened in her failed bid for the presidency.
You can share your thoughts by calling us at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of the renewed healthcare battle and Hillary Clinton's return to public life. Call 800-642-1234.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian. Sabrina, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this Obamacare repeal effort kind of came out of nowhere. It's been percolating out there for a while. It suddenly got a lot of momentum. Why is that?
Well, I think that it's been a bill that Senators Lindsey Graham and Cassidy were working on in the background as the other efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare by Republicans over the summer failed to pass muster. But now I think they see this last-ditch effort to make one more go or have one more go at overhauling the health care law. And what they want to do, in essence, is to give a lot more control back to the states. But a lot of people have said that as far as the Republican plans we've seen in recent months, this would go the furthest in terms of really shifting the power structure, but also eliminating many of the coverage requirements that were created under the Affordable Care Act.
Right, and Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is a co-sponsor of this bill, I should add, for the Wisconsin audience here. What are some of the other changes that the Graham-Cassidy bill would make?
Well, I think that one of the biggest issues that has come up is whether or not it covers pre-existing conditions. And in essence, it does allow for waivers that would pave the way for insurers to charge sick patients with higher premiums or to potentially stop covering certain pre-existing conditions entirely. It also does eliminate the Medicaid expansion, which was, of course, responsible for some of the biggest impact on coverage under Obamacare. It tries to create block grants, which is a longstanding Republican proposal for Medicaid. We don't yet have the numbers on how many people might lose access to the program if this bill were to go into effect, because the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has yet to score it. One other thing that has come up as well is this bill would eliminate certain essential health benefits as they were deemed under Obamacare, and so that includes maternity care, prescription drugs, potentially also certain mental health services, and it eliminates the health insurance marketplaces, of course, that were created under Obamacare.
Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley was talking to Iowa reporters. He's been quoted today saying, you know, I can maybe give you 10 reasons why this bill shouldn't be considered. But Republicans campaign on this so often that you have a responsibility to carry out what you said in the campaign. That's pretty much of a reason as the substance of the bill. This is a guy who's going to vote for the bill, as I understand it. This doesn't sound like a lot of enthusiasm there.
You know, that's a very striking comment from a top Republican on Capitol Hill, and I think it reflects some of the thinking within the Republican caucus and the pressure that has mounted on Republicans, given the fact that they control both chambers of Congress as well as the presidency and have been unable to follow through on a seven-year promise to repeal and replace Obamacare. But at the same time, they're now contending with the fact that the health care law, despite its flaws, has expanded coverage to upward of 20 million Americans. And so what would be the consequences of enacting this this new legislation, Graham Cassidy, it could very much come down to, as we saw with the efforts over the summer, one vote in the Senate, whether it's Lisa Murkowski from Alaska or John McCain from Arizona. It looks like Rand Paul and Susan Collins, two of the other Republicans, are very much against this measure, and it would need that 51 simple majority to pass. And then it would still have to go over to the House, where you are hearing some skepticism already from Republicans there, too.
Talking to Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian, about some of the top stories and national news. Before we move on from this health care law, there's a ticking clock here for Republicans to get this passed with just a 50 with just 50 votes, plus maybe a tiebreaker from the vice president. What changes after September 30th?
Well, I think that there are a lot of competing priorities before Congress right now, and one of those is notably spending for the federal government. They did kind of kick the can down the road with this short-term deal that Democrats had negotiated with President Trump to raise the debt limit through mid-December, as well as to pass a government funding bill. But one of the other issues that has come before them is the need to stabilize health insurance markets, and that's something that at the moment is a result of some of the insurers pulling out of Obamacare because of a lot of the uncertainty surrounding the law's future. And so I think there's this added pressure when you take into account, you know, the budgetary deadlines that they face, as well as their own goals to also move on to tax reform and then going into a pretty long recess over the holidays. It really is, in the eyes of many Republicans, a now or never moment. But then again, that's what they said as recently as July, when the Senate failed to pass its plan at that time to overhaul Obamacare. So you never know. It seems to be one of these issues that keeps cropping up every 6 weeks or so.
Speaking of things that keep cropping up, 2017 has been about reliving the 2016 presidential campaign, and Hillary Clinton gave us a new reason to talk about that with this new memoir she has out. You covered part of her tour. You went to an event. How's it being received?
Well, I think that it's interesting because there's been some criticism, of course, that has been levied at Hillary Clinton for reigniting the feud in a way with Bernie Sanders. She's very critical of the way in which he inflicted lasting damage in her eyes on her campaign. And then it kind of reopens the rift within the Democratic Party on whether they really embrace the Sanders style of progressivism versus a more centrist, pragmatic approach, which is what Hillary Clinton advocated. And then there's just her being very candid and reflecting on the role that gender played, misogyny and sexism, and how she was treated, and being very direct and frank in how she talks about race and immigrants and some of the anxieties and anti-immigrant attitudes that led to Trump's success. So I think that, you know, there are some people who would rather not have these conversations, but there are also many people across the country, especially when you leave Washington, who I think are very interested in what Hillary Clinton has to say, having been on the losing end of an election that everyone had thought that she was certain to win. And, you know, we'll talk about it, I think, a lot here in Washington, the politics of it, is it the right moment? But other candidates have not been precluded from speaking out. There just seems to be this opposition directed at Hillary Clinton in particular, and I think that speaks more to some of the perception of her that she seeks to address in the book.
On this book tour, an interview asked Hillary Clinton who she preferred, her former opponent Donald Trump or Russian President Vladimir Putin. Here's a clip of that.
Putin or Trump? Yeah, well, I have to take that under advisement for the following reasons. I ran against both of them.
And this has been a lot of the talk in Hillary Clinton's media interviews, and I guess in the book, too, which I haven't read myself yet. But she's talking about the Russian interference in the election on her book tour.
Yes, and that's actually a very dominant theme I neglected to mention, that part of the book is Hillary Clinton not only gives a behind-the-scenes perspective in a way that I think is very cathartic for her, having read the book. It's very emotionally raw. It's very candid in a way that a lot of people wish she had been on the campaign trail, but part of her motivation, she said, is also to provide some lessons that she felt should be learned from the way that this particular election played out. And she thinks that there was not enough seriousness that was dedicated toward what Russia was doing when the intelligence community had already said, as early as the summer before the 2016 election in November, that there were clear attempts by Russia to meddle in the outcome, as well as potentially to help prop up Donald Trump's campaign. So I think that this is one of those issues where, you know, this has actually been, of course, a big part of how the media has covered the Trump presidency thus far, with the cloud of the Russian investigation looming over the White House, and Hillary Clinton, especially given her own background as Secretary of State, she dedicates a pretty lengthy portion to discussing and dissecting what Russia is capable of in a way to try and warn the media, I think, in particular, as well as lawmakers, to take it more seriously and to have a better understanding and framing of what Russia's motivations are.
We're recapping some of the big political stories of the week with Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian.
And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you support Republicans' renewed effort to replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare? Do you think that they'll be able to pass it? And what do you think of the Secret Service no longer protecting Kellyanne Conway and Donald Trump Jr.? You can call in at 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the week in Washington. Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian, is with us recapping some of the top political stories.
And you can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you think of Hillary Clinton's return to the public eye with her new memoir. Also, lawmakers in Silicon Valley are at odds over a sex trafficking bill. You can tell us whether or not you think that bill should pass. Call 800-642-1234.
And Sabrina, let's look at that sex trafficking bill. You wrote about this. You've been covering it. It's gotten some angry response from Silicon Valley companies. Can you spell out what's at stake here?
Yes, this is actually an interesting issue that has really pitted lawmakers in Washington against big tech. And Silicon Valley has emerged really as one of the most influential, if not the most influential, industries on Capitol Hill. They now outspend Wall Street 2-1 on lobbying in Washington. And what this is doing, this bill, is amending what's known as the Communications Decency Act, amending a section of that law to open up internet companies to criminal liability depending on certain user conduct. What happened is that there was this one particular site, Backpage.com, that, according to a two-year investigation, knowingly facilitated online sex trafficking. And so the idea here is to tweak existing law that has shielded internet companies in the past from being held accountable for what third-party users post to their websites, to try and bring more accountability and enable victims, especially, to pursue litigation against internet companies if they aren't doing a good enough job to crack down on online sex trafficking in this case. But of course, you know, internet companies are saying that this opens up a wave of privacy concerns, that it could amount to frivolous lawsuits. They say it's not as narrow as it's described to be. And some of the tech giants who are kind of leading the charge against this are the big names, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon. Where it's going to go remains unclear. Yesterday they had the first hearing in the Senate, but it has broad bipartisan support, 30 co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle in the Senate. And as I'm sure you're well aware, that's very rare nowadays in Washington.
Yeah, it seems like the concern is that, okay, if you've got a company that's in effect an online personals ad like this Backpage was, it looks like they specifically covered up what was sex trafficking of minors in some cases. That's one thing. The concern from Silicon Valley is, well, does that mean Facebook has to police all messages to make sure somebody isn't doing something like this? Does that mean Google could be liable if someone does an internet search that ultimately connects them with illegal sex trafficking? Is that kind of the line of concern that they're raising?
Yes, absolutely. And I think especially with social media websites like Facebook and Twitter, you know, just if you, for example, have a line of communications between users, does that mean that Twitter or Facebook are now liable for facilitating illegal activity just by having the existence of that platform through which these individuals can communicate? What the bill's authors say is that, no, this is very narrow, and you have to prove criminal intent on the part of the website itself. You have to say, like in the case of Backpage.com, that the executives or the moderators of a particular website were aware that this was happening and that they knowingly, that's where the knowingly comes in, facilitated it and did not take any efforts to eliminate and report to law enforcement that kind of activity. So I think that that's what really the heart of the issue is. There are certainly some, there's a pressure campaign that's been mounting. Some public figures, such as former UN Ambassador Samantha Power, comedian Amy Schumer, they came out recently in favor of this sex trafficking bill. 21st Century Fox, which is, of course, the parent company of Fox News, they endorsed the bill. So there is some, I think, momentum for it, and the question now becomes, are lawmakers going to stick it to Silicon Valley, where they certainly also raise a substantial amount of money?
Talking to Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian, looking at some of the top stories in national politics over the last week or so. So some news about Secret Service protection for President Trump's family and a staff member. Donald Trump Jr., Kellyanne Conway, apparently no longer getting Secret Service protection, each for a different reason. Can you talk about that story?
Yes, well, Donald Trump Jr. actually requested to be removed from Secret Service protection. According to reports, he has sought more privacy and said that he, you know, was uncomfortable with some of the encounters that he and his children have had with Secret Service officials. I think that, you know, he suggested, for example, that, you know, one of his sons was sleeping, there were Secret Service agents or chauffeurs who were taking photos of him while he was sleeping. That was something that I think was really angered Donald Trump Jr. And, you know, he at the end of the day is not actually working in the White House in the way that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, for example, are. So it seems like he wants to keep a distance. Whereas for Kellyanne Conway, you've had a slightly different case where the question, I think, is the need for Kellyanne Conway to retain that protection. I do know that it's not immediately clear whether she did it by choice, Kellyanne Conway, but initially she was subject to quite a number of threats, especially given her exposure in the early days of the administration as one of the most prominent faces of the administration. And I think the question has been whether the threat level has changed.
And we've seen stories about the Secret Service being strained, their resources during the Trump presidency. Why is that? Have they had to do a lot of additional security, or are there higher costs because of proximity to Trump Tower and resorts?
Well, there has certainly been a higher cost, and some of it has to do with the president's own travel schedule. As you'll recall, in the earlier days of the administration, he was traveling to his West Palm Beach resort, Mar-a-Lago, almost every weekend. And since he's been going to Bedminster in New Jersey almost every weekend, with very few weekends actually spent in Washington. He obviously has an extended family that, as we were just talking about, has been under Secret Service protection. And these are not children, as was the case with some of the previous administrations living in the White House, but adult children and their families who live in New York and other cities. And then there's also been this other issue where you've had some of the cabinet officials who, of course, are granted Secret Service protection, but who have been using certain government resources in terms of charter jets and added Secret Service agents that is more unusual and is costing the government and, in turn, U.S. taxpayers a lot of money and raising eyebrows. And so I think there are a number of competing factors that have led to the status quo.
Is that something that Democrats are calling for inquiries into at all?
You know, Nancy Pelosi was, interestingly enough, asked about one case in particular where it appears that both Tom Price and Kellyanne Conway had used a $25,000 private 30-seat charter for a round trip from D.C. to Philly. And she, you know, Nancy Pelosi said that, you know, so they should be held accountable, but it doesn't look, and there have been some Democrats who are saying that they would like this to be probed. And this is not the first incident. You also had a scrutiny over Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, reportedly having requested a government charter for his honeymoon with his wife. So, I think that you might see in the Federal Spending Oversight Subcommittee some action, but at the end of the day, Republicans also control Congress, and you haven't heard as much criticism from them. I think there's just so much volume of news that this has sort of been one of the untold stories of the administration, or one of the ones that hasn't really received as much attention, is a lot of these questions around conflicts of interest, in part because we're living in a very unpredictable, high-volume news cycle, and there's only so many issues, I think, that even members of Congress are able to grapple with at once.
And before we wrap up, three Democratic members of Congress were arrested outside of Trump Tower for protests. What were they protesting?
Well, one of the prevailing questions is what the president plans to do about DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program under Obama that, of course, provided nearly 800,000 young undocumented children, known as Dreamers, with at least temporary protection from deportation. Obviously, the president decided that he would like to phase out that program and gave Congress a narrow six-month window to enshrine protections for Dreamers into law. So that the protests were very much pertaining to what the Trump administration is willing to do for these kids. We do know that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have increasingly been working with the White House. They met with Trump twice over the last 2 weeks, including a private dinner that didn't include Republican leaders, to try and lay out a path forward. They said that they did agree to come up with some sort of DREAM Act-style legislation that would give these kids a path to permanent residency. But the president wants it to be paired with border security, and that's the operating question, I think, is what does border security mean to Trump? Does it mean the wall? He's been wavering on whether or not he will insist on a wall. And what does border security mean to Democrats? Are they willing to give some concessions in order to find a way to remove the threat of deportation for, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids who came here, who were brought here illegally when they were simply children? They've spent, you know, the vast majority of their lives living here in the United States.
We'll leave it there for now. Sabrina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian. She joined us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics.